the music. Cut the music.
I think I got my swagger back.
Spectacular group of men. You go find them, you throw your arms around them, you give them a big kiss on the mouth if you're a girl.
Oh, the band is out on the field. He's going to go into the end zone.
There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game.
Like poison. Like rat poison.
Are you going to listen to me or are you going to listen to these guys?
And welcome to the College Football Country Podcast. I am Josh Parcell, CFBCountry.com, the host of the College Football Country Podcast, the website, the whole nine yards. You know the drill by now. Today's episode is going to be with Kyle Bailey. We loved it so much last week. We're bringing him back for week two. And before we get started, do not forget, go rate and review the podcast on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play, wherever you're listening to the podcast right now. I need the five-star reviews, but also the review. And last week, we got a great number of reviews. Your favorite college football player of all time, maybe your craziest name of all time. Kyle, I gave you a week. Do you have names for me this week? You didn't do it, did you?
Well, yes. Mm. I did the one, but I wanted to come up with like three or four to impress you. But the one I got today, and it's not even all that outlandish. It's just a guy that I don't know why. He's always stuck with me since I was a kid. I thought it was the coolest thing watching a guy named Major Applewhite, quarterback Texas. Like, I mean, that's not obscure because obviously he's still coaching, but that will always, to me, be one of the coolest names in the history of college football.
Well, what's the most Texas quarterback name we've ever had? Because Colt McCoy, right.
Yeah.
Colt McCoy, Major Applewhite, I feel like are neck and neck. God, I feel like there's some others that have been out there, not just at Texas, but just like Texas A&M.
Tim Riggins.
Tim Riggins. But like Colt, what was the name of the what was the name of the hotshot QB in Friday Night Lights? Not Saracen, the kid, J.D. McCoy. J.D. McCoy needs to be the starting quarterback at South Lake Carroll. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, well, that's true, yeah.
Yeah. So many.
Well, I played softball with a guy named J.D. McCoy. And it was after Friday Night Lights. So I always thought that was the coolest name. I'm glad you said that one. I haven't thought about that one in a while.
Man, that was made for TV. But anyway, yeah, go rate and review the podcast. When you leave your name, just leave your favorite college football player of all time, maybe the most random college football player of all time, whoever has the best name, most creative name, you will win a $25 Amazon gift card if we get to 150 reviews by the end of the season. Ooh. So we need about 45 more to go. So go take care of that now. What are you waiting for? Without further ado, let's get to the podcast. And now I welcome on, for real, Kyle Bailey, WFNZ. He hosts Garcia and Bailey from 2 to 6. They bat cleanup on the lineup for WFNZ. Mm-hmm. We're not the leadoff hitter. We're like Kyle, you're a baseball guy now. Yeah. So I feel like back in the day, the guys who batted like second in the lineup were just your get-on-base contact guys. But I feel like now, from what little I know, I'm going to embarrass myself right now because I haven't watched a full baseball game in probably 3 years. Is it just everybody hits home runs now? Is that what it is?
Not enough of them, I'll say that. I mean, everybody's concerned about their launch angle, but not everybody.
I feel like leadoff hitters now have to like hit for power.
It doesn't hurt. I mean, right. But you still have plenty of traditional leadoff hitters out there. But
would Ricky Henderson like be an all-star Major League Baseball?
Yeah, but Ricky Henderson also had some pop. I mean, like Ricky Henderson was a stout dude. Ricky Henderson could leave the yard. Nobody ever doubted that, right?
Right.
So like when the Braves hit Ronald Acuna at the top of the lineup this year, right?
Right.
That's a little bit of a novelty, but it's also not that strange. You know, like if Mike Trout leads off, you know, it's not quite the same thing, but like traditional leadoff hitters. Yeah, they're not quite as common as they used to be, but they're still pretty common.
Yeah, I feel like to complete the analogy here, Mac in the morning, Mac swings for the fences. Mac's wild. He's taking hacks out there all the time. And then Nick and I come in and I don't know. I don't know what the perfect analogy is. We probably hit some singles and doubles. I don't know that we're hitting home runs. We certainly get in probably more brawls. Well, I don't know. You and Frank might get in some brawls too. Who's the Earl Weaver, or the George Brett of the lineup WFNZ?
I think I'm the George Brett.
Probably.
Frank would have to be the Earl Weaver. There's no question. Yeah. I would almost go Frank more of a Bobby Cox, though. Because, like, the older he gets, the outbursts are fewer and further between, where like Earl Weaver went to the grave undressing somebody. You know, but Cox picked his moments. So
right.
I would go that route.
Yeah, that's probably fair. All right. Well, so you can catch us every day. I'm on from 10 to 2 with Nick Wilson. Kyle, of course, from 2 to 6.
And by the way, thank you, Lucky Stars, every day that you're not hitting leadoff. Because I don't know if you've ever done morning radio. You never get used to the alarm clock going off at 3:30 in the morning. Like, it never becomes normal. It's never okay. And even Mac and T-Bone, 14, 15 years into this, will tell you that. I did morning radio in Charleston. It takes a special breed of human being to do morning talk radio.
I'll be honest. Well, I don't know how you do it when everything that happens in sports is after 7 o'clock. I mean, you're trying to watch Monday Night Football. The game doesn't end until 11:30. How on earth are you going to stay up for that, wake up 4 hours later, and do a radio show where, guess what? You got to be on a 10 at all times in terms of energy. You got to bring it. And I don't know that I could ever do it, man. I mean, when I was back doing personal training for a little while, I had to wake up at 4 a.m. plenty of times to teach classes, and you got to have energy in those. But I got sick of that real quick. So I'll happy with 10 to 2. If you ever go national, Kyle, I'll be happy to take your drive time slot. But
sounds good.
I'm going to stick with 10 to 2 for now. I like the wake-up call around 7 a.m.
There you go.
Anyway, let's get into ACC football. This week, we got to start with Florida State. I think that's by far and away the biggest story. Maybe nationally, honestly, right now, is the dumpster fire that is the Seminoles. And they go into Syracuse last week and, I mean, lay an absolute egg. And we talked last week. I was still on the bandwagon. I was trying to give Willie Taggart the benefit of the doubt. I saw a team that through 2 weeks laid a complete egg against Virginia Tech. I get it. Played 4 days later against Samford in a game where I think it's acceptable for you to kind of be a little sluggish. But to go against Syracuse on the road, not a hostile environment, below average ACC team, I don't care what you say, they haven't had a winning record since Dino Babers got there. Yes, they've had some nice wins, but consistently speaking, Syracuse is not one of the better teams in the ACC.
Yeah.
If you stack up talent on both sides of the aisle there, Florida State runs circles around Syracuse. They're going to have more players in the NFL. Top five recruiting class every year from 2014 to 2017. Jimbo did not leave the cupboard bare. There might be holes here and there on the roster, but not enough holes where they should be getting blown away by Syracuse. And that's exactly what happened on Saturday, 30-7. The Orange absolutely demolished Florida State. The offensive line, the big question mark. So I guess my question to you here, Kyle, to lead it off is Willie Taggart actually on any sort of hot seat right now? Some people have some very strong opinions about this one way or the other. Is it too early to be having this conversation, or have you seen enough to think that maybe Florida State made a mistake bringing Willie Taggart on board?
It is too early. He is absolutely not on any hot seat at Florida State right now. It's far too early, and it is ridiculous. Like, I have some strong feelings about Willie Taggart at Florida State, and as strong as my feelings are that I don't think he is going to have a long, successful career there, I don't know that yet, and I do think it would be so obscenely, absurdly wrong to make any kind of determination about that 3 games into his tenure there. I do believe that. I don't think he is the guy. I don't think he's going to be there long-term, but it is too soon. It's not going to happen. It's hyperbole. If for no other reason that even if Florida State, no matter how you feel about the Florida State job, good job, great job, elite job. I mean, obviously, I think it's one of the top 5 jobs in the country personally. But even they're not cutting a check for $21 million to send a guy away after a season. Now, if he wins 1 game this year, 1 game, I still don't know that they'd fire him. I don't think they would. But if next
1-11,
I know.
Like, I don't know, man.
If you win 1 game at Florida State, you probably deserve to be fired. And it's certainly, I think, a sign of things to come and a pretty clear indicator you can't do this job. That said, I don't think they're going to win just 1 game, but I don't think they're going to win any more than 4. I think this is a pretty bad football team. And I also think that Willie Taggart has already shown us a litany of reasons to believe why he's not going to be there very long. And can I also say, without getting us off on a tangent, because I know you have kind of an agenda here, but like I just opened up another article from the Tallahassee Democrat, right? And this article, they cover Florida State, Jim Henry, and he opens this, and it's kind of a let's get the fan base optimistic and hopeful and not trash it because we need clicks. You know, it felt like one of these. And it's not an insult to Jim Henry. I know what they're doing here. But the opening of this article says there is trouble in paradise wherever that may be for college football fans. At Florida State, 1-2. At Nebraska, 0-2. At UCLA, 0-3. Okay. While I understand all 3 of those programs are kind of in a bad spot right now, Josh, can we please stop lumping them together? Because while I know that things are bad at UCLA and I know that things are rough right now at Nebraska, Nebraska has exactly 0 players on the same caliber as Florida State, at least in terms of raw talent. UCLA does not have very many there. Florida State does, for a fact. But more importantly than that, I'm going to turn this over to you. Scott Frost just went 13-0 and beat Auburn in the Peach Bowl. They have a claim to a national championship. Scott Frost has a lineage as a player unlike anything Willie Taggart has. Chip Kelly's won three Pac-12 titles, and Oregon played in the national championship game, 4 years ago, okay? One of these things is not like the other, and that thing, that person is Willie Taggart, and that's not a disrespect to Willie Taggart necessarily. Well, I don't see it that way. Some will certainly see it that way. Willie Taggart is not in the same class as those guys right now. He does not deserve the same benefit of the doubt as those guys right now, and more so than the losses to Virginia Tech and Syracuse, the way that he's acted after those losses and the way that he's kind of subtly fished for the same excuse is really, really telling to me that he might be in over his head.
Yeah, and I think that he understands the pressure that's on him, and I think he's trying to deflect that a little bit with reacting the way he is and being as nonchalant after the games, where I think a lot of Florida State fans want to see a little more fire in him right now. You bring up Scott Frost. First of all, Willie Taggart has made a habit of staying at schools 1, 2, 3 years at the most and then leaving. Scott Frost did the ultimate turnaround, okay? He's earned a lot more credibility than Willie Taggart. Scott Frost took a team that didn't win a game in 2015, takes over in 2016, wins 6 games. The next year goes 13-0, gets the fake national championship or whatever. But he has proven that, as far as turnarounds go, ain't nobody doing it better than Scott Frost. So he's earned a little bit more credibility. Also, he's had a backup quarterback end the game against Colorado in a game in which they still had a chance to win on the last play and then play the entire game against Troy. So he's had a major injury that is probably reason number 1, 2, and 3 why Nebraska's 0-2. They'd probably be 2-0 right now if Adrian Martinez is healthy for the full Colorado game and then, of course, against Troy. And then UCLA, Chip Kelly comes in and while I don't want to give him a full pass for being a coach who has a certain system and doesn't have guys to fit his system, UCLA has recruited fairly well, nowhere near the level of Florida State. They don't have top 5 classes like the Seminoles, though certainly not every year. But again, Chip Kelly, it's going to take him a little bit of time. That's a more of a reclamation project. Florida State had expectations this season to be at least a top 25 team, at the absolute worst. This is a team that was favored by a touchdown against Virginia Tech. This is a team that some thought could compete with Clemson in the ACC. It was a long shot, but people thought there was a real chance. I said before the season, and not that I'm an expert, but I thought that on paper, Florida State had similar talent to Clemson. They do. I mean, outside of the offensive line, which we know now is just even worse than we thought, but you look around the running back, quarterback, especially on defense. The defense actually hasn't been a big problem for them. Defense has played pretty well.
Yeah.
This team is so, I think, so much closer to Clemson in terms of talent, quite honestly, than it is to Syracuse. I mean, I think this team is.
Josh, look, you don't even need to keep making the point because you're right. I mean,
right.
The deal here is that go check the offer lists for every single one of the 22 starters on Florida State's roster right now. I bet you their offer lists all look the exact same or at least eerily similar to the offer sheets or the offer lists of the kids that are playing at Clemson right now, the 11 on both sides of the football. It's not even a debate worth having. It's the truth. If you want to go pour through it, go ahead and do it. That's exactly what you'll find. So what's the difference? Dabo Swinney, Brent Venables, Tony Elliott.
Yes.
As opposed to the other side. Now, I get it. Willie Taggart and his guys have not had a great deal of time with these kids, but he brought back Mickey Andrews. This offense is supposed to be lethally simplistic. And it's Florida freaking State. Like, I'm just so tired of all of these, well, they're not his guys. It's early. It's this. It's that. And I keep going back to this example because it's the most recent best example in the same damn conference that I can think of. Justin Fuente came to Blacksburg with an offense that Scott Leffler had just twisted into knots with kids who did not have the same offer sheets, the same talent as Clemson and Florida State's guys do. And in year one with a JUCO transfer quarterback, he took them to the ACC championship game.
Yep.
So I don't want to hear that from anybody. I'm sorry. I don't hope that Willie Taggart is fired. I don't hope that he sucks. I just wish people would recognize that there are some pretty clear indicators here. He's not an elite head coach. That's it.
And it certainly seems that way right now. And
I'm sorry for being so long-winded.
You look at Florida State and I compare them to some other national championship teams in the last 20 years. I went back and I looked. Since the BCS began in 1998, there have been 3 teams that have won a national title and had a losing record within 5 years. Okay, and this would be year 5 for Florida State since they won the title in 2013 with Jameis Winston. You had Auburn in 2010, won the national title with Cam Newton. 2 years later, they go 3-9. They had the same head coach as when they won the title. So they had Gene Chizik, who was then fired after going 3-9. So he had been there for a while. The program had gone south. There was reason to get rid of him, of course, after a 3-win season. In 2008, Florida won the national championship. They went 4-8 5 years later. So, and Florida has never been the same. I mean, you talk about Will Muschamp was the coach then. He coached one more year. He wasn't fired after the 4-8 year. They gave him one more season. He had been there for 2 years prior, but there was at least a track record again. They gave him one more year, and then he was out. 2005, Texas, totally different scenario. You had an entrenched head coach, a Hall of Fame head coach in Mack Brown, wins the national title in 2005, and then in 2010 goes 5-7. And that, not only were they 5-7 there, they had gone to the national title and lost the year before. He ends up coaching three more seasons, probably should have been out earlier, and a lot of fans wanted him to be gone sooner. But if you look at those three teams, the only one that's rebounded since then is Auburn. And they bring in Gus Malzahn. But Florida and Texas, two programs that were at once at national championship levels, held on to those coaches for several more seasons, and the program only got worse.
Yep.
So you run the risk if you're Florida State in year one at 3-9 or 4-8, if that's what they're looking at this season, and I don't know if that's what they're going to end up being. Maybe they do get to six wins. But if this team struggles and doesn't make a bowl, it might not be the worst thing in the world to cut bait before it's too late, because all you run the risk of doing is driving the program further into the ground. They've recruited extremely well. Willie Taggart has done a great job selling hope in into this program in the offseason. But when you're recruiting, you can sell two things, hope and success. And that you can sell hope until you start playing football games. Once you start playing games, you got to have success. If Florida State can't prove it on the field, he's going to have a hard time recruiting against the likes of Miami, who – while I have my criticisms of that program, they're certainly at a higher level right now than Florida State. Dan Mullen's probably going to end up having a good enough year at Florida to at least be able to recruit on the level of Florida State, if not better.
Right.
And now, I mean, hell, UCF, USF, those guys are still they're battling for those recruits, not to even mention Alabama, Georgia, and the rest of the SEC who's going to come into Florida and compete with you too. If you can't have success and you don't have that hope anymore, that hope is gone, what are you selling? I think Florida State, while I don't know who they would bring in after this season, I don't know that Willie Taggart should be on the hot seat. I think if he wins four games, they're going to give him one more year. But just buyer beware, because the writing's on the wall. Teams that have won the national title and then the program has taken a nosedive within the next 5 years, it's hard to get back. It's harder than you think. You might think, like, Texas thinks that they're a national championship contender every year. That fan base thinks they're the crown jewel of college football.
That's
so does Florida. But
that's
the problem, is when you get to that level and you have that kind of success, the fan base expects it every year, and you start to things start to unravel, things start to snowball. And if you give a coach maybe a year or two more than they really deserve, it's that much harder to get back to the top. It is not easy. You don't just snap your fingers. Nick Saban has almost ruined college football because everybody thinks that you can just hire a head coach and win a national title in your second season. It just doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't happen, man. Look, I'll say this definitively with this, what I believe, barring some sort of dramatic, catastrophic change here, they're not firing Willie Taggart. They're not cutting bait. You cannot cut a check for $21 million to pay a guy to go away after a single season. No matter how much I believe he's not going to be there long term, you can't make that move. It's irrational. Now, what you can do is, if it stays bad, you can cut bait with him in year two or after year two, and it still probably seems a little bit knee-jerk, but not after a year. You devalue your own job if you fire a guy after a year and cut bait for $21 million. Like, there are ramifications, you know, that come with that beyond just a new coach and winning football games. So I that's why I don't think there's any chance they fire him after this year. Let me also say this really quickly, and I don't want to belabor the point. There is a connection to the Harbaughs with Willie Taggart that I don't know how much it matters, but I do think it's interesting that Willie comes from the Jack Harbaugh, Western Kentucky kind of family, and, you know, he cut his teeth there, and so because of that, it's like automatic street cred when you come from that. And I don't get it. Like, Jack Harbaugh was a successful mid-major college football coach. There seems to be, like, a mythology surrounding him, which I don't pretend to be an expert on that program or that era, so I won't try to speak about something that I don't know a ton about. But it almost kind of seemed like he came with this instant credibility because of that maybe wasn't necessarily earned. And I don't know. I have a hard time. I know how hard these guys work. I know how much time they spend in the office. I know how high pressure these jobs are. I also know how well they're compensated, so I don't feel that bad about being critical of them. I know Willie Taggart is a good football coach. You don't get to that level without at least being a good football coach. But relative to his peers, he's not great. He may not even be all that good. And I thought Florida State made a mistake when they hired him in the first place. So I don't know, man. I think this is a fascinating situation. And I don't think you're wrong to point out that if they don't carefully monitor this situation, that it could have long-lasting effects, like you've seen at Florida, like, well, and more so Texas, which continues to be absolutely bizarre to me. I just thought it was automatic that Tom Herman was going to have success, and early on, you know, at Texas, that's not been the case. I think they're probably still going to get better, but I'm not as convinced that Tom Herman is an elite head coach or that he's going to win a national championship at Texas as I used to be.
Well, and we're going to talk about future. We're going to talk about second-year, third-year head coaches, some of the guys who were hired a couple years ago. It's maybe early to make sweeping judgments about Willie Taggart, but once you have a couple years under your belt, we can start to scrutinize you a little more carefully. We'll do that now. Let's talk about guys that were hired in 2016. Ooh. So now you got coaches entering their third year with programs. That was a big year in the coaching carousel. A lot of big names were on the market, and a lot of big jobs were on the market, were available, and that was the year, to refresh people's memory, you had Justin Fuente go to Virginia Tech. You had Tom Herman at Texas. Clay Helton got the full-time job at USC. Ed Orgeron got the full-time job at LSU. You had Charlie Strong at South Florida. Mark Richt went to Miami. Kirby Smart got the job at Georgia. So there's a lot of coaches.
You forgot Bronco Mendenhall.
I didn't forget Bronco Mendenhall. Actually, he's not going to make this list. I'm about to throw out there.
All
right. I'm going to rank on Friday on CFBCountry.com. I'm going to rank those coaches and who's doing the best job so far. Kind of a midterm report, I guess. None of these coaches are probably, well, some of them might be in danger of losing their job after this year, but some of them have had a lot of success. Some of them, it's already turned south. Some of them, right in the middle. I want to rank these coaches. I want to get your reaction to this on who's had the most success so far. I'm going to start, I'll go 5 through 1. I'm going to rank more than that on CFB Country, but number 5, I'm going to say Ed Orgeron at LSU, and because of where the program is today. I mean, you look at LSU, where they are right now.
Oh, yeah.
I have them as one of the top 5 teams in college football to this point. I think that could go south very quickly, though, for a few reasons. But you cannot deny what they've done this season. Now at Orgeron, he's finally hired an offensive coordinator in Steve Emsinger that seems to have things humming a little bit better than what they were last year. I mean, nothing could be worse than what happened last year with Matt Canada and that whole situation. So now at Orgeron and LSU, they seem to be a contender in the SEC West, mm-hmm. at least maybe not counting Alabama, but they're a contender for number 2, which is good enough. The direction LSU is going. Number 4, Mark Richt at Miami. Now, Richt had a heck of a year last year. Of course, got Miami to the ACC championship game. A little bit of fool's gold, which we'll get to in just a minute. Number 3, I actually think Charlie Strong and the job he's done at South Florida has been outstanding. I mean, building that program after it kind of was in a state of flux for a little while, and then yep. he took it over. Willie Taggart was the one who he replaced, ironically. But Charlie Strong's done a great job picking up where they left off. They may be a dark horse for New Year's Six Bowl this year. And then number 2, Justin Fuente. I think Justin Fuente is the second best hire among any coach from 2016. And number 1, Kirby Smart. I mean, Kirby Smart gets the Georgia to a national championship game. I don't think you can deny that. The Kirby Smart has had the most success of any coach who was hired a couple years ago. But because this is an ACC show and I want to dial in to the ACC coaches on this list, you have Justin Fuente and Mark Richt. I want to know, I see Justin Fuente as having had more success than Mark Richt to this point. Do you think that's fair to say? Because I think there's going to be a lot of fans. I'm anticipating the reaction that a lot of people are going to say Mark Richt has done a better job and that Miami's a better program than Virginia Tech right now.
Why?
Well, because, one, people are going to point to what they did last year, but getting to an ACC championship game and beating Virginia Tech. And I think people have that recency bias, and they think about what they just most recently saw between those two programs.
Okay.
But if you look at them, the body of work since they both took over, Mark Richt took over a Miami program that had 23 wins in the 3 years prior to him being hired.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia Tech had 22 wins in that span. So you're mm-hmm. basically talking about two programs that were very, very similar in terms of the success they had in recent years. Both programs were down. Both programs are used to having more success than they had.
Right.
And so they both entered very, very similar circumstances. Then you talk about cumulative score between the two games. Virginia Tech blew out Miami 2 years ago at home. So they've traded blows. Okay, when Miami came into Lane Stadium 2 years ago in Rick's first year, Virginia Tech won that game by 21. The cumulative score in those games, 47-44. So Virginia Tech has actually outscored Miami in the two games combined by 3 points. It's neck and neck. You can't use last year's game in Miami as an indictment on Virginia Tech and say that's why Miami is the better program right now, because Virginia Tech did the same thing to Miami a year earlier. The difference in my mind is what happened when they got to the ACC championship game. When Virginia Tech got to the ACC title game and took on Clemson, that game was in Orlando, they came within a touchdown of sending Clemson to overtime and maybe beating Clemson for the ACC title. That was
inside
the game,
not quite that, inside the 25 with, 7 seconds to go.
Exactly. Yeah. Final minute, they had a chance and couldn't quite make it. And actually, I will correct myself. They would not have gone to overtime because Justin Fuente has said on the record they would have gone for two.
They would have won or lost that game. Yeah.
God, what a great what if. If Virginia Tech had scored there, make or miss that 2-point conversion, that would have been one of the most memorable moments in the history of the program. Yep. But I digress. Miami went to the ACC title game. They lost 38-3. Okay, they did not even hang on by a thread against Clemson. I mean, they were beat from the very get-go against the Tigers. I think that Justin Fuente has taken a program at Virginia Tech that had, in my opinion, less talent than Miami from the beginning, and has already built the program to where they're the favorite to win the Coastal this year. At this point, based on what we've seen from these two teams so far, Virginia Tech's the favorite to win. They get Miami in Blacksburg this year.
Yep.
I think Virginia Tech going forward has a higher they have a higher ceiling than Miami because of Justin Fuente.
Yeah.
What's Mark Richt's ceiling? Mark Richt already showed us at Georgia he's not going to win a national title. If he didn't do it at Georgia, how's he going to do it at Miami?
I don't why would I think that he is? I mean, why would I think that? And I don't know. I feel like I beat this drum all the time, but it's still so true, and sometimes I wonder how people who cover this sport professionally either forget it, ignore it, or just don't see it. These two teams, let's wipe away, not what's the wrong word. Miami deserves all the credit in the world for the national championships it won in the late 80s, early 90s, and certainly the Clinton Portis teams of the early 2000s, right? But since these two
interesting
teams,
you went Clinton Portis. Of the 85 Miami players, that was the one you went with.
He's the one that stands out to me.
Yeah.
But anyway,
okay.
Ever since these teams joined the ACC 15 years ago, all right, one of these teams has won 4 conference championships, and the other's won 0, right? One of these teams has a 25-year bowl streak, that I think is about to officially become the longest in the country when Florida State fails to go to a bowl game this year. You know, it's these things that are forgotten, and we still point to the great old days of Miami football in the early 90s as justification for giving them the benefit of the doubt and just assuming that even though they've given us a decade and a half of failing to do the thing they were supposed to do, while the other team I'm talking about did those things repeatedly, that we should still give Miami the benefit of the doubt. And I feel like I'm being really long-winded here, but Virginia Tech and Miami are two vastly different schools in vastly different places with different reputations and probably a different level of access to certain resources and players. You know, Miami's got so much talent in its backyard, but Miami's athletic department situation, not to get too in the weeds here, is very different from Virginia Tech's and, the money they spend and this misperception that Miami just is, printing money. Miami financially, doesn't throw the bank at the football program the way some people might assume that they do.
There have been – now they're upgrading in the near future.
But they have
notoriously – if people who are in the business who follow this thing, they know – Miami has had arguably the worst facilities in the conference for several years.
Yes.
And that's that would shock a lot of people who don't follow that.
Right, and it's just now being addressed.
Right.
Why? So anyway, I bring that up. I'm going to get out of the weeds here and just come back to the fact that I double-checked this number to make sure. Since taking those two respective jobs, both Mark Richt and Justin Fuente have a record of 21-8. Like, they have identical records of 21-8 since they took their respective jobs. I just think at this stage in his career, Justin Fuente is a better coach. Who do I think has better talent on the roster top to bottom? Miami does.
Yeah.
Miami absolutely does, and it's not even a debate. Like, I wouldn't even entertain that conversation. They do. Justin Fuente, paired with Bud Foster, is a much better coaching situation for the next couple of years than is Miami.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to agree with you, and that's the problem.
Let me punctuate that really quickly by saying the reason I emphasize that is that, as you well know, Josh, you know better than anybody, college football is about the coaching. And how good is your coaching? How stable is your coaching? And it's Virginia Tech and spades right now over Miami because you have two guys who just take care of their sides of the football and are among the best at doing what they do.
Yeah, I mean, I think Virginia Tech quietly might have the best coaching duo in the one of the best coaching duos in the country.
And let me not be disrespectful to Manny Diaz here. That guy can coach his tail off.
I think Diaz has been as influential as Mark Richt in why Miami was. Think about what Miami won with defense last year.
Oh, absolutely.
They won with defense. With as much as I hate it, the turnover chain, the takeaways, all that stuff. I mean, Diaz is going to get a head coaching job soon. Some people think that he's going to succeed Mark Richt in a couple years when Richt kind of rides off into the sunset. He does his job, cleans up the program, and then hands it over to Diaz. I don't think that'd be the worst idea in the world.
Probably not.
But Diaz had a huge role in that. So, no, they've got a great coaching duo as well. I mean, you could go through the laundry list of staffs that have great, great duos. And I think Virginia Tech, I'd put them up with just about anybody right now.
Yeah.
Having said that, the point I like to make about Miami is Miami and USC are very similar programs, very similar makeups. Glamorous cities were great 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Private schools.
Cheated their tails off to win national championships. It's reality.
It is.
You say what you want, and I know that everybody in college football cheats to a certain degree. Okay? What Miami and USC did when they were winning titles, they cheated to a level that was – they got caught. I mean, you can cheat around the – they were so reckless with the way they cheated where USC – I mean, USC – was sending, I mean, obviously the Reggie Bush situation is what became their downfall, but let's talk about Matt Leiner and Bush and all those guys. I mean, you're in Hollywood, the amount of glamour and attention that you can get. It's one thing to get a car in Tuscaloosa or in Blacksburg or in Happy Valley, okay? When you're insulated, and we could get into a much longer discussion about the way the local police and everything kind of protects a lot of guys in those small towns, but I think that that's important. Like, and not to get into the legal side of this, but there's a lot of distractions in L.A. and Miami.
Yeah.
And those kids, I'm sorry, but when you're 18 and 19 and you're going on yacht parties on Saturday night after the game, that's a heck of a lot different than being the big man on campus going to the bar in Blacksburg or going to the bar in Tuscaloosa or going into College Station, okay? There's a reason why the best programs in college football are in smaller college towns. Name a program in the last 15 years that has had a lot of success that's in a major pro market city. There isn't one. There's not a single one because those kids, I'm telling you, when you get into L.A., when you get into Miami, they're worried about 100 other things other than football. And when you get told from the time you step onto campus that because you're a, you know, you play for the U or you play for USC that you're a star, you think that you're already a celebrity and you get exposed to the true celebrity lifestyle. The celebrity lifestyle in a real college town is different. You can focus on football even when you have the other distractions that come with being a big-time player, big-time college football player. It doesn't compare to me to the stories that you've heard about what Matt Leinart was on. It was on TMZ, for Christ's sake, when he was the quarterback at USC. I mean, it's just so different, I think, the amount of scrutiny and attention that gets put on you. I think that puts a ceiling on Miami. The only reason Miami won, and USC for that matter, is because when they won national titles, they didn't have to practice. They didn't.
I know.
I mean, you talk
it's
about
a very
40,
different landscape.
40 NFL players on a roster. USC was right behind them. I mean, those are probably the two most talented teams. The 04-05 USC, the 2000-2001 Miami teams are the two most loaded teams in terms of NFL talent we've ever seen in college football. And it doesn't matter what you do Monday through Friday. When you are that good, you can roll out of the bed and beat anybody. And I think that's what Miami's never going to get back to that level unless they cheat their face off. And Mark Richt's not going
to
do that.
Dude, I mean, I just to your point a second ago, you start talking about, you know, big cities and, you know, metropolitan areas and things like that. I'm thinking, well, there's got to be one or two exceptions, right? There's got to be one or two.
Where are they?
I'm looking at the top, the AP top 25 right now. Tuscaloosa, Athens, Clemson. Columbus is the only thing
closest
close.
Thing.
That's a closest
thing. And that's in Ohio.
What's that?
It's in Ohio.
Oh, dude.
You're not in a beach town. You're not in a big I mean, Columbus is as close as it gets.
You start rattling off some of the – I mean, South Bend. Maybe Palo Alto, again, kind of close but not really. You know, Auburn, Alabama, Happy Valley, Morgantown, Blacksburg, Oxford, Stillwater, you know, Orlando for UCF, they never, okay, maybe they are the exception that we point to, but Fort Worth, Camp Randall, Ann Arbor, Eugene, College Station, East Lansing, you know, these are not bustling hubs of metropolitan activity.
That's the reality of college football. Last thing before we kind of wrap that conversation up, if you were Texas right now and you could go back in time 2 years ago, would you hire Tom Herman or Justin Fuente?
Justin Fuente.
I think I would too.
Like we have the benefit of hindsight, obviously.
Well, I know, but that's the point. At the time, Herman was the guy. Herman was the home run hire.
Sure.
Not saying they should have hired Fuente at the time, but if you look at it now, I mean, and I think Herman's going to be fine at Texas. I do think that Texas is eventually going to be a force in the Big 12 again.
Texas, of course they will.
But But I think that I might go with Fuente. I think Fuente has proven
I wouldn't hesitate
he can
to
do
with
more
Fuente.
With less than Tom Herman. And, yeah. and Herman did a great job at Houston. Obviously, was a tremendous coordinator at Ohio State. I think Fuente is and people are going to call us biased for saying he's one of the, he's maybe the most underrated coach in college football right now with what he has done. And we'll see what happens this season. If he can beat Notre Dame, if he goes to another ACC title game this year, 10 or 11 win season with this talent,
yeah.
I think you have to say he's one of the most underrated coaches.
Well, no, you have to say he's the. I mean, and look, here's the thing, and I think this is what gives you know fans of that program hope, but I also think it's kind of the new trend in college football, just seeing how many of these monstrous college football factory programs have chewed up good coaches and spit them out. Justin Fuente really learned from Gary Patterson. Gary Patterson's team just played in primetime on Saturday night under the lights against Ohio State, put on a hell of a showing. And he's taken that program and turned it into something that is consistent year over year that can compete with the biggest in college football. I mean, a couple of years ago, Josh, you know, we're talking, is it TCU or is it Baylor? You know, and
right.
you know, who's going to get into the college football play? The Texas Christian University Horned Frogs are considered one of the big boys in college football. You don't have to, you know, sure, if you aspire to be the head coach at Texas, if you aspire to be the head coach at Alabama or USC, or maybe in Justin Fuente's case, Oklahoma, you know, okay, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But when you know where something fits and you can make a lot of money, maybe not quite as many millions as you could at a few other stops, but you can still make many millions of dollars coaching football in a place like, as you said, Blacksburg or Oxford or any number of secluded, insulated college towns where you're the big fish in a little pond. You exercise almost complete control over not just your own team, but the athletic department,
right.
You know, local officials. You're basically the governor in some of these places. Who wouldn't want to maintain that sort of status and stability and security? And that's a guy who I think understands that completely because what he's seen Gary Patterson do at TCU.
That is, for Hokie fans, probably the most reassuring thing you can say, is that if he truly wants to model Virginia Tech after TCU, Fuente is going to be here for a long time, and he's going to have a lot of success. I don't know if he's ever going to win a national title. I don't think that's really in the cards for Virginia Tech, I'll be honest with you. I don't think Virginia Tech's ever going to win a national championship. I think they can get to a playoff. Alabama and Georgia are going to recruit on a level that's so unparalleled with what Virginia Tech's ever going to be able to recruit. When you get to that level, I know we talk about coaching, you have to have... especially in the playoff era where now you got to win two games instead of just getting lucky and winning one.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be real hard for those second-tier programs, which is a great tier.
But I actually disagree with you.
You think Virginia Tech can win a national title?
I think they can, and I think if they're going to any time in the next 25 years, it will be within the next 5 years. That is the nearest chance they have because I'm telling you, Justin Fuente is a legitimate elite head football coach in college football, and Bud Foster is as good, if not better, than anybody to ever do what he does. They have an opportunity right now. I was surprised, honestly. I was surprised by the level of athleticism they have on both sides of the ball right now when I watched them that Monday night against Florida State.
Right.
You know, I know people that of all fan bases listen to this, so I don't want to make this a very our alma mater-centric podcast here, but even I was surprised that they had that much size and speed and athleticism and they were able to put it on the field, not just put it out there, but competently. And Bud Foster's defense, they may have some hiccups this year, but in the next two seasons, that group, if they stay healthy and together, is going to be one of the best three defenses in the country. So, you know, maybe the Quincy Patterson era paired with a Bud Foster defense, an elite Bud Foster defense, I think they've got a shot to get in there. And if you get in and it just takes two games to win it, they've got as good a shot as anybody, except maybe Alabama. But, you know, they're going to get there. Now, after that, man, I think all bets are off because they're not Alabama. There's no – the lineage isn't there. The resources aren't there. The history's not there. The cachet's not there. It's known as one of the best football programs in the country, but it's not known as a blue blood or one of the elite of the elite. So it's got to happen, I think, in the next 5 years, or it may not happen.
I think that – first of all, I totally agree with you. 2019 and 2020 are the years. That's the window for Virginia Tech to make a playoff.
Because Bud Foster's not going to keep doing this for too much longer.
He's not going to keep doing it for much longer. The team this year is so young, and the schedule next year especially, so easy, that Virginia Tech's going to have – I think 2019 is really the big year. You can talk about Quincy Patterson down the line. That's fine. Josh Jackson's probably going to be the quarterback next season. You and I may disagree on that. We don't need to go down that road. We'll see. But regardless, they're going to have – almost everybody back on defense. They're going to have almost everybody back on offense. Certainly all the receivers are going to be back. They're going to lose Stephen Peoples and pretty much everybody else at running back is going to be back. I mean, this team is going to have a veteran-laden team that's clearly well-coached, experience at quarterback, in my opinion, and a relatively manageable schedule. The difference is when you get to the national championship, when you get to the playoff, I think what's going to keep Virginia Tech from competing with, and when I say Virginia Tech, honestly, I mean any team in that kind of 8 to 15 range, the Wisconsins of the world. You talk about even Texas A&M, although they're recruiting better now. But those programs that are not the Blue Bloods but are right there nipping at their heels, you got to have a transcendent quarterback. I think that's the only way those next-tier programs can step up. I mean, Oregon. Oregon got to the national title with Marcus Mariota.
You got to have a transcendent quarterback to win it, right? Not just not to get there, but to
win
it.
Yes, to win it all. To win the national 100%. Title, I think you have – and that's honestly and that's part of the formula of beating Bama.
And again, not to drag you into that discussion, but that's why I would disagree with you that if it's going to happen, it's going to happen with Quincy Patterson.
Maybe so. And
that's if he's anywhere close to the real deal.
We don't know that, and I think that's where it's going to be tricky. Then that's the delicate battle that Fuente is going to have to fight next season. As far as this year goes, Fuente has done such a terrific job. If they get to 10 or 11 wins this season, beat Miami and win the Coastal, I mean, Justin Fuente, first of all, should be coach of the year in the conference. Second of all, like you said, probably the most underrated coach in college football. Virginia Tech's never going to get the same type of attention nationally that you're going to get if you're at Alabama, Ohio State, Texas, those programs.
Or Miami.
And, I mean, yeah, think about it. I mean, the way Miami, the amount of attention Miami got last year for going, what, 9-0? And then losing their last few games? Or I guess, what were they? Well, were they 11-0 and then lost to Pitt? They were 11-0, lost to Pitt, and then lost two straight. They went 11-3. If Virginia Tech's 11-0, yeah, they're going to get love, but they're not going to get the same kind of love that a Miami got. Virginia Tech would be looked at a lot more like an Iowa than a Miami.
No.
Think about Iowa.
Josh.
Yes, they would.
No.
Nationally?
Iowa's a punchline. And not because they're terrible. It's because they're so.
I don't think people would give them a shot. If Virginia Tech you got to say they would go through Clemson, but if Virginia Tech was 11-1 the regular season, won the Coastal, beat Clemson, I still think they'd be a long shot in the eyes of the national media to win the national title if that were to ever happen this year. If Miami was 11-1 and won the ACC Coastal and beat Clemson, they might be the favorite. I mean, they certainly would get a lot more hype, attention, credit than a Virginia Tech would if Virginia Tech was in the same
spot. I disagree with you, and here's why. Because the old regime, and again, I know that you and I just have this natural inclination to linger on these guys, but when Frank Beamer lost a lot of big games, for all the things we love about that guy, he lost a lot. As a matter of fact, he lost most of the big games that he coached in. Justin Fuente is now 2-0, you know, in big-time games to start the season against marquee programs. Now, yes, Florida State is not – they're a mess. But the talent is still there, and it was still on the road in Tallahassee with his own, with Fuente's own group of completely unproven guys.
Well, right, exactly. That's the key.
He can
it was
coach,
young.
Yeah. And so he is establishing himself as a big game coach. Right now, that doesn't necessarily mean as much if you line up in the playoff against a loaded Alabama, a loaded Georgia, you know, a loaded Ohio State. I know that, but wait a minute, Ohio State—they went and beat him in the shoe, man. So like. That's why I take issue with Iowa. That's the thing I take issue with. The rest of it is fine, but because they're never going to have as much cachet, they're never going to get as much benefit of the doubt. It's the Iowa thing that I disagree with, because to me, they are again kind of a punchline, and not because they're embarrassing or they suck, but it's because Iowa is just this constant line of monotony and just boring enough until Kirk Ferentz has 1 year out of every five where they're just fast and physical enough and competent enough on the offensive side to get to a Rose Bowl, and then they drop back off and we forget about them for five more years. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of who they are to me. Whereas this team that we're talking about has established not only a consistency, but, you know, for what it's worth, four conference titles in 15 years. Iowa can't say that.
Yeah, that was a long time ago, though.
But Miami is still. Miami's cachet exists off of national titles that were 25 years ago.
I think national titles are a little different than conference titles.
You're right about that. You're right. You're absolutely right. Totally right. But Iowa.
I'm not saying Virginia Tech is Iowa, but again, the Big Ten West and the ACC Coastal ain't that different.
You're out of your damn mind. How do you go from arguing with Brando to that? Give me the equivalent in the West of Miami, Virginia Tech, and Duke right now.
Well. Oh, okay, Duke just beat what, Northwestern, right?
They just beat Baylor.
Well, yeah, but then they played Northwestern.
Yeah, 21-7 at Northwestern. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to make that
shut
comparison.
Shut down the offense.
So I think the Coastal is a little bit better than the Big Ten West, but I don't think it's that big of a difference. You've got Virginia Tech and Miami at the top. you have Wisconsin, which has had more success than either Virginia Tech or Miami in the last 10 years. Period. I mean, they've been to Rose Bowls. They beat Miami last year in the Orange Bowl. Wisconsin's a better program than either Virginia Tech or Miami in the last 8 years. I don't think you can argue that. Now, if you want to go back further than that, maybe it's a debate, but Wisconsin was great before that with Barry Alvarez, too. So Wisconsin's strong. Now, that number two team in the Big Ten West might be Iowa, okay?
Right.
Now, Iowa—
And that's where the argument gets lost.
That's where the Coastal might have a slight leg up, but at the end of the day, what has Miami been for the last 15 years? Like, we've been bagging on Miami for a while.
Sure.
Iowa's probably had more success than Miami for the last 15 years.
Okay, fine.
So then if you go 1-2,
you want to go back to
the Big Ten West number one's been better than the ACC Coastal's number one. Their number two's probably been better more recently than the ACC Coastal number two. You can make a case the Big Ten West has actually had more success with those programs.
No, because look, you
want to go back 30 years, it's different.
No, North Carolina just went 11-1 a couple of years ago and flirted with the college football playoff. Georgia Tech, you know, has been in New Year's Eve bowl game or New Year's Day bowl games and won 9 and 10 games. You know, we could, again, I don't want to drag you down a rabbit hole for this sort of thing, but like I just don't see the Big Ten West. I think the Big Ten West is the worst division in college football, and I think that's definitive. I think the Big Ten did itself a disservice in the way that it carved up that conference, and I truly believe that they should look at making some swaps. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Talk about Nebraska. I know Nebraska's down right now and has been down for a little while, but they have not been atrocious. Like, if you tell me who's the better program over the last 15 years, Nebraska or Duke, that's probably
Duke.
Pretty Duke has been better than they've ever been before,
right.
But, I mean, last 15 years, I still think Nebraska has probably been just about as good. Nebraska played for a Big 12 title. I mean, this is predates the Big Ten era, but just like Duke did. I mean, Duke played for one ACC championship. Nebraska made that Big 12 title game when they lost to Texas in Dominican Sue year. Colt McCoy threw the ball away. 1 second left. They ended up winning on a field goal. So I think if you got on the line of just what the programs have done in the last decade or so, I don't think it's that different. I think you could make a case. You could make a case the Big Ten West has had more success.
Get out of here. All right. Anyway.
I mean, this is an ACC podcast, and we are bagging on
the
division.
It's like I'm working with Frank, and you're trying to troll me right now.
Okay. Well, it's certainly not Brando. So, anyway, let's get to some picks before we get out of here. Some big games this weekend. As I pull up the schedule, you've got probably the last week of marquee non-conference games for some of these teams before we really get into the thick of ACC play. Let's start with a game that's quasi-ACC. Notre Dame, 7.5-point favorite on the road against Wake Forest. Tricky game for Notre Dame. They just coming off of a close game against Vanderbilt, a game that was closer than it probably should have been. Notre Dame's offense has struggled all season. They weren't great against Michigan. Dirty little secret. They beat Michigan, but the offense wasn't great. Certainly wasn't great against Ball State. Wimbush struggled in that game. And then they struggled again against a Vanderbilt team that has a good defense, but certainly not world beaters. Do you think that Wake Forest has enough at home as 7.5-point dogs, one, to cover the spread, two, do you think they have a chance to pull the upset?
Yeah. It's college football. I've been tinkering with this one back and forth like the last 2 days, because when I first saw the line, I was like, oh, yeah, Notre Dame's going to cover. Not a problem. That's the direction that I'm going. But, you know, having seen Wake now, been tested against BC last Thursday, and look, Wake played pretty well. I mean, there are a couple of mistakes there that doomed them, but they played well.
Play action pass killed them in that game.
Sam Hartman's going to be a problem, you know, for most of this conference for the next couple of years. That kid can spin it. Like, he's tough. I like him. Is he ready to author an upset of Notre Dame, though? I think the answer is no, but I think he's got just enough. I almost used the word grit, and I would have hated myself
Moxie.
For that. Yes. I think he's got just enough
moxie.
He really is. I think he's got just enough moxie, which is a great word for this, by the way, to make you think that he's about to upset Notre Dame, until he doesn't. So for that reason, I think Notre Dame wins by a field goal, you know, 4 points. But I actually am leaning strongly right now to like Wake plus 7, Wake plus 8, whatever the line's at right now. I'm leaning in that direction.
If you can get this with the hook, 7.5,
yeah.
I would hammer Wake Forest.
Yeah.
Because they've, like you said, Sam Hartman, Dave Clawson is one of the more underrated offensive coaches in the country.
Hell yeah.
I mean, you talk about what they did last year, generating the offense they did with John Walford at quarterback. Sam Hartman is following in his footsteps. Clearly doesn't have the experience of Walford, but This offense can score points. They scored on BC, which BC has pretty good defense, and Wake Forest moved the ball and scored points on them. They just couldn't stop BC's rushing attack.
Uh-huh.
Notre Dame doesn't have the rushing attack that Boston College has. Mm. A.J. Dillon's better than anything Notre Dame's going to bring to the table on Saturday in Winston-Salem. I think Wake Forest covers this game because I think they can score points, and I don't think Notre Dame against any – I mean, they could only score 24 against Ball State.
Talking about Bovada – I got to get to Bovada.
There you go, 7.5. Hit it right up, okay? So I think that's going to be an easy bet for me. I would love 7.5. Now, if it gets to 7, I would still take it. You bring the push into the equation. But 7.5 to me is a great, great value for a Wake offense that's going to be able to score points. Now,
yeah, I agree.
It could be a good buy-low opportunity for Notre Dame. But Notre Dame is another team like the Miamis and Texases of the world that just get a lot more credit, especially in the betting world, by the public than they really deserve. I think they're a little overrated. I think they're going to find out this weekend. I'm not calling for the upset, but it would not shock me. Wouldn't shock me.
No. As a matter of fact, I do think Notre Dame probably wins the game, but I think Wake Forest is going to put a scare in. I see a game where Wake Forest is leading at one point in the fourth quarter, possibly.
Could and it seems like the type of game Notre Dame wins where you're like, how the hell? With 3 minutes to go, it's 35-31, and Wake's driving, and then they fumble a snap over their head, and Notre Dame wins the game. It's like one of those games Notre Dame pulls out at the last minute.
At the end of it, we're praising Sam Hartman. Oh, he had a chance there, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Yep. All right, so we both like Wake Forest in that game plus the points. How about let's go Boston College -6.5, big road favorites at Purdue, who's 0-3. I tend to think Purdue's going to cover this game. And I won a good bit of money last week on Purdue +6.5 against Missouri.
You think Purdue wins the game?
I think that Purdue is 0-3 and is desperate as hell for a win. And Jeff Brohm is one of the best coaches. I think he's the better coach in this game. No disrespect to Steve Adazio. I think Purdue goes in and with their backs against the wall at home, beats a Boston College team that is good. And I'm not taking away anything from them. Purdue's rushing defense has not been stellar by any stretch. One of the worst in the Big Ten so far. I'm just taking a team with their back against the wall. A home dog by a touchdown is too much value for me to pass up. I definitely think they cover. I think this is another tight game. I'll take the better, more explosive offense in Purdue.
Okay.
I don't know that it's the better offense because obviously we know what A.J. Dillon can do. But I think Purdue's more wide-open attack. I think they can score quickly. And if the game gets into a shootout, I still like Purdue's chances to cover.
I don't know that I would touch this game with a 10-foot pole, and it's because I don't have a great feel for it. Because on the one hand, I could see Boston College, if they are indeed that good along the offensive line, manhandling Purdue and just chewing up clock, controlling the football, long sustained drives, even if they don't result in scores. I mean, just long sustained drives, and that they end up winning this game something like 21-14, or something along those lines. At the same time, though, I think Boston College is good, but I don't know how good. And I think they're really good up front, but are they good enough on the back end that if Purdue gets hot offensively or that if Purdue and Jeff Brohm really come with a great game plan, that they are athletic enough to defend Purdue in that passing attack? And I think there's also a chance that with Rondale Moore and, just a couple of those guys that I think can make some plays, that Purdue could potentially actually beat this team by like 10 points. Like, I don't know. I don't have a feel for this game at all.
I'm telling you, I'm betting on Jeff Brohm. I'm betting on Jeff Brohm to get this team where it needs. Mizzou's a good football team, and Purdue slid in the back door late to cover in that game. That was a game where they had a chance to win, couldn't get it done. Mizzou's got a prolific offense, and Purdue hung with them. And BC ranks first right now in yards per attempt on defense, but that is skewed because they played Holy Cross and UMass to start the season. So you really can't use that as a barometer for how good this pass defense is. I think Purdue does enough, and like you said, if a game where BC controls the clock, I think that favors a home dog because fewer possessions, smaller margin of victory. Even if Purdue loses, I think this is a tight game down to the wire. I'll take 6.5 and run with it all day long.
But yeah, I don't blame you. I don't know.
Tough game to pick because we don't know quite yet how good BC is. One more game to pick before we get out of here. Clemson taking on Georgia Tech. This game in Atlanta. 16.5-point favorites, the Clemson Tigers, on the road against the Georgia Tech team, missing Kervante Benson, the running back.
Throw the entire checking account at Clemson.
I think so,
the whole thing. Borrow some more money to throw it at Clemson. Georgia Tech sucks. I mean, they're not a good football team. Pitt, which is also not a great football
team.
Shocked
me that Georgia Tech lost that game. Could not believe and lost badly. That game was not as close
as the
score.
Let me ask you a question really quickly because, I think emphatically we both agree. Put all of your money on Clemson immediately and then, take out some credit cards and put more. But also this, have I know we've probably asked some variation of this question before. Has the league completely figured out Paul Johnson's offense?
That's a great question. You might be right. I mean,
And I don't even know if it's a fair question. You tell me.
3-4 years ago was the last time they made it to an Orange Bowl. I mean, it's been a while. They certainly aren't dominating the league like they once were. They still run the ball really well, but I'll tell you what, the one team that might not have figured it out, you're going to disagree with this, is Virginia Tech. Bud Foster had it figured out for a while. Georgia Tech's owned them the last couple years. So they've had some trouble with Georgia Tech. They can still sneak up and beat you. It's just a tough team to prepare for. There's a lot of variables involved, but
I say figured out, not in that they can never win games, never ever be successful, because at the end of the day, I work with a guy who says this all the damn time because he played in the NFL for 10 years and he still coaches to this day. It truly is about the guys executing the plays on the field, who you have inside those helmets and shoulder pads, and not just about a scheme. Even in college football, that's still the case. So when Georgia Tech has a group full of seasoned veteran guys who are able to redshirt, you know, a couple of years under their belts, they stay healthy, Georgia Tech with that offense can still beat some of the better teams in this conference and can absolutely beat teams across the country who don't see this offense very often, if at all. But when Georgia Tech does not have great athletes, or if Georgia Tech's just a little bit banged up, or if Georgia Tech's young at the quarterback position just a little bit, I feel like they're more likely than other programs to have a prolonged stretch of losses or to take one in the teeth from a team they probably shouldn't. And that's kind of the way that I see Georgia Tech right now.
I'll be honest with you, man. You want to know when Georgia Tech's good? When they have an elite wide receiver.
Oh, yeah, the one.
When they have a Demaryius Thomas or a Stephen Hill, the guy that, when you're not careful, can beat you for a 40-yard bomb, that can keep the defense honest and force them not to load up eight in the box all the time, that's when Georgia Tech has been at their best, and they haven't had that guy in 4 years. Stephen Hill left the team in, what, 2013? I mean, it's been a while. 2011. So they had the one good year where they went to the Orange Bowl, I believe, in 2014. But outside of that, they have been very mediocre for the last 5 years. They were great early on when they had those receivers. That changes the complexion of their offense a lot. I think, going to this game specifically, I think that Clemson has underachieved in every game they've played this season, even against the Cupcakes. This is a chance. I think Clemson is sick and tired of struggling and playing a lethargic game. I think that they use this game as a chance to take their frustration out, and they truly put the wood on to Georgia Tech. And not to mention the fact that Clemson's defensive line is the last thing Georgia Tech needs to face. I mean, that defensive line, I think, is going to dominate against that Georgia Tech front. A lot of times you talk about defending Georgia Tech, you talk about the linebackers as well, because those the Georgia Tech's blocking schemes are going to cut block the heck out of defensive line, force linebackers to make plays. But that defense for Clemson is going to shut down Georgia Tech. I think they win 41-14. It might even be worse.
Real quick, I just went back and looked. Paul Johnson took over Georgia Tech in 2008.
Yep.
He won 9 games the first year. Won 11 games the second year, and we know all about 2009, but won 9 games, won 11 games, won 6 in 2010, 8 games in 2011, 7 games in 2012, 7 games in 2013, 11 games in 2014, right? So at Georgia Tech with that offense, that's a pretty nice run, you know, of you know, some big-ish years, some flat-out big years. Ever since then, 3 wins, 9 wins, 5 wins, and one win so far this year that I don't know that they win more than 4 games this year. I'm not sure. Because when you look like that against Pitt, and, well, I'll just say it this way. I don't think they're very good. I don't think they're very talented. I think they're always well coached. Paul Johnson knows how to coach that offense. He knows how to coach a football team. I just don't think they're that talented.
Well, defensively, they're struggling. They're giving up over 5 yards of play. Clemson's going to be a loss. They get Bowling Green the next week, and then you talk about Louisville. That's maybe the best chance. That and UNC are the best chance they have for wins the rest of the year. Yeah, I think this team's ceiling is probably 5 wins. I mean, I think 5 is the best-case scenario you're going to get. They don't seem like a team that's ripe for an upset this year against the likes of Virginia Tech or Miami. Of course, they play Georgia at the end of the year. That's going to be embarrassing. So I'm with you. Maybe the league has caught up to Paul Johnson a little bit. Certainly seems that way. They've kind of petered out. Would not surprise me if Georgia Tech has a new head coach in a year. I'm just going to say it. I think that this is probably going to be the end of the run for Paul Johnson, unless they surprise us and somehow turn this thing around and win 7 or 8 games and give them reason to keep him around for another reason. Or he might turn into the next Kirk Ferentz to complete the coastal Big Ten West analogy.
Look,
there you go.
I'm with you on that. By the way, just quick sidebar. I'm so tempted. I'm getting married next month. Yeah, next month. We've been talking about kids, right? You get married, you start having conversations about kids. What do you want to name your kid? What would you name if it was a boy? I think we should have like a short list of things that we're going to. I'm so tempted to name my first son Chan so I can name him Chan Bailey.
Oh, yes, Chan Bailey.
I'm so tempted to do it. I have no idea why.
Would your wife, A, get it? Like, do you think you could
She didn't get it at all.
Did you tell her?
I did. I explained
it. Oh, see, you shouldn't tell. See, because she probably said no after that, right?
Yeah.
See, you shouldn't have told her and then waited until after you named the kid, and then there's no turning back. That's what I would have done. She never would have known.
I think she might forget. I still may try. But there's just something cool. I don't know why. It's a dumb thing. I'm not a Georgia Tech fan. I don't even like Chan Gailey all that much. I don't dislike him, but I mean, I don't have any real strong feelings about him. It's just something funny about
him. You can name him Dan, and then he could just be the next great kicker.
That's true.
Dan
he could Bailey, be the next great
Dan
kicker.
Dan Bailey the second.
Are we wrapping this thing up?
We are wrapping this thing up.
Just real quick. I know it's not. I was joking. I was going to throw this in there. Get all over LA Dodgers -1.5 tonight and the over 7.5.
All right. There you go. The closet Dodgers fan, Kyle Bailey, who. Gives you a little bit. We started the podcast with baseball. We ended it with baseball.
See, I was hoping you would pick up on that.
There we go.
All right.
Appreciate that. So make sure you guys download the podcast. Go find it. CFB Country on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify. It's on all those places. Rate and review the show as well. And we'll be back next week to talk more ACC football with Kyle Bailey. Kyle, thanks a lot.
Yeah, man. Thank you.